Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It's the News Roundup, where we talk with area journalists about some of the stories making news headlines this week. Starting next week, the last internal components of the nuclear reactor at the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station will be moved to storage vaults as part of the decommissioning of the plant. Also, Pilgrim's parent company is restructuring, which raised some suspicion on the State Nuclear Advisory Panel. CAI's Jeanette Barnes has the latest on this. Good morning.
Hello, Mindy.
So I know there are multiple storylines anytime we talk about Pilgrim. One of them is the progress on dismantling the reactor itself. So talk about the status of that.
Sure. Work is starting next week to put the last internal components, as you said, of the nuclear reactor there in Plymouth into concrete storage vaults. That work is going to continue into July. Of course, those components are radioactive. They're eventually going to be sent to a waste burial facility in Texas, but not for about 2 years because the transportation containers still need to be designed and receive federal approval. Holtec, the company that owns Pilgrim, is doing that design. They have to submit the plans to the federal government. Then the Nuclear Regulatory Commission reviews those for approval. All of that can take 2 years. So in the meantime, the components will be in those vaults in Plymouth. Then next year, Holtec is planning to remove the outer shell of the reactor, which involves cutting it up and then also shipping it out.
And the building that contains the reactor isn't going anywhere for a while, right?
No, it's not. There's a lot more in there. There's other hardware and structures, including the torus. The torus is this donut-shaped chamber and below the main vessel of the reactor. My understanding is that when the plant was operating, a torus would have been used to suppress excess pressure in the reactor if that were needed for safety. Normally, the torus is partially filled with water, but soon it's also going to contain the water from the spent fuel pool at Pilgrim. That's going to be drained down into the torus early next year. The plans to dispose of that water from the reactor system have been a very big source of conflict, as we've reported. And those plans are the subject of an ongoing appeal at the State Department of Environmental Protection.
Yeah, so what's the latest on the water situation?
Yeah, we are still waiting for a final decision from the Commissioner of Environmental Protection on this appeal. Just some quick background here. Holtec applied to discharge that reactor system water into Cape Cod Bay. The state denied it. Holtec appealed. Then an appeals officer with the state issued a recommendation that the case be decided against Holtec. But the recommendation doesn't really become a final decision without that action or approval by the commissioner of the Department of Environmental Protection. It has been 6 months since that recommendation. The commissioner has not acted. Rosemary Shields brought this up this week at the Nuclear Advisory Panel meeting. She is not a member of the panel, but she speaks at a lot of the meetings. She represents the League of Women Voters of the Cape Cod area. And it was a good reminder hearing from her that it has been since November. It's been 6 months, and this decision has not been finalized. The commissioner, Bonnie Heipel, can finalize it at any time, and there's no deadline, though, for her to do it. So I talked with an agency spokesperson this week to try to get a sense of when it could be coming. Essentially, all they're saying is that she's reviewing the recommendation, that these recommendations are many, many pages, is a lot of legal details, and she's reviewing multiple recommendations at one time, but she will issue, they said she will issue a final decision, but really no specifics on like a time estimate. And people in the community are starting to speculate that the state is hoping to avoid a lawsuit by delaying this decision, because as soon as the decision is finalized, it can be appealed in Superior Court, which is a lawsuit.
And the water continues to evaporate into the outdoor air while this is going on, right?
That's right. The volume of water that's being held inside Pilgrim is getting lower. And people on both sides of this debate about what to do with the water have acknowledged that evaporation does have more potential to expose people to air, to pollution, than discharging the water into Cape Cod Bay. So the evaporation is a big concern for some people. The state says however, that the potential to emit air pollution from evaporation is far below the threshold that would trigger an air pollution permit in Massachusetts. Couple caveats to that. One, the expected emissions are based on data from the operating company, Holtec. Not necessarily a problem, but there's an element of self-reporting there. Also, the state is referring there to state-regulated pollutants, which are non-nuclear. The federal government regulates the nuclear material that's in that water. Now, to be fair, the nuclear material is also expected to be within government limits. But certainly for some people who live either near the plant or downwind from the plant on the Cape, being within government limits really is not sufficient. They remain concerned about the possibility of health effects and environmental effects.
Yeah. And you reported this week that Pilgrim's parent company is creating two new companies with responsibility for Pilgrim. That move prompted some criticism. So tell us about that.
Yes, we just learned about this. So as I spend a lot of time when I'm doing my writing juggling corporate names because Holtec International is the parent company. It already owns two other companies related to Pilgrim, the ownership company and the licensed operator. Now they're creating two new ones. They're called Holtec Holdings Incorporated and Decommissioning Asset Management Company, LLC. At this state panel meeting this week, the primary questioning about this came from Andrew Gottlieb. He's a member of the state panel. He's also the executive director of the Association to Preserve Cape Cod. And he, at one point, he called the new companies shell companies without really going into any detail about that claim. And he said Holtec wasn't being transparent about what it was doing. David Noyes was there from Holtec. He is the site vice president for Pilgrim. He says they're not shell companies, but he did say that federal regulations prohibit full disclosure of the final corporate structure. And prior to this questioning part of the meeting, he did say a little bit of what one of the companies would be doing, that decommissioning asset management. He said it will be managing the decommissioning trust fund and major expenditures at the plant. Another thing that I think is interesting to bring in here, that after all of this, a member of the audience, Susan Enten of Quincy, she was on Zoom, but she asked about Holtec's interest in building small modular reactors. She didn't specifically link that to the idea of the creation of these new companies, but both things, the new companies and the modular reactors, are things that Holtec says are part of its business future. Mm. David Noyes from Holtec, he said that siting small modular reactors is part of the company's plans. He says the locations under consideration right now are in Michigan and New Jersey, and that Holtec does not have plans to do that at Pilgrim. Of course, the other part of that is I'm sure that does not mean that a company could not change its plans as time moves on.
Oh, boy, a lot to digest there. CAI's Jeanette Barnes. Thank you, Jeanette, for being on this.
All right. Thanks, Mindy.
White sharks are back in our local waters. And this week, CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb Noyes checked in with the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy in Chatham to see what's on the horizon for white shark research this summer. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Mindy.
So what are shark scientists planning for the summer?
Well, they're trying to learn more about a population of juvenile sharks in Cape Cod Bay. There have been increasing reports of small sharks in the bay over the past several years. Many fishermen have had their catch stolen off their line by some young sharks out there. Megan Winton is the senior scientist at the Atlantic White Shark Conservancy, and she calls the bay the next frontier for white shark research on the Cape. So far, shark research on the Cape over the past 15 years or so has focused on those large white sharks preying on seals off the outer Cape.
So is this the first time they're going to be studying this younger population?
Well, actually, they started last summer when over the course of only about a week, they tagged 17 small white sharks in the bay, but they plan to expand on that work this summer. They'll be using all kinds of tags, including camera tags, to see not only where the sharks are going, but what they're doing while they're there.
Ooh, interesting. And so when you say juvenile white shark, how is that defined?
It's defined as up to about 9 or 10 feet long. These size sharks focus on eating fish, squid, smaller shark species, skates, and rays. It's not till they reach about 10 feet when they begin to hunt seals. So that's when they'll start hanging around where the seals are along the beaches on Nantucket Sound. It's interesting that scientists talk about white shark development in terms of body length instead of years. That's because they're really understudied, and to this point, they don't necessarily know exact ages. Greg Skomel is the state shark biologist, and he says sharks in the bay are likely between 3 to 5 years old on the young end and could be up to teenagers, he said. And those sharks aren't fully mature until they're in their 20s, and he said they can live to be 70.
Wow. All right. And you also reported some good news on the upcoming hurricane season. We always like to hear good news when it comes to hurricanes.
That's true. Yes. NOAA is predicting below average activity this hurricane season. That's due to a predicted strong El Nino. El Ninos tend to lead to quieter Atlantic hurricane seasons. But that effect is tempered by predicted warmer water in the Atlantic and also weak trade winds. So those two things both tend to lead to stronger hurricane seasons. And I'll note on the El Nino side, El Nino has the opposite effect on the eastern and central Pacific. So NOAA's predicting an above average storm season out there.
So how many hurricanes can we expect this season?
They're calling for 8 to 14 named storms, and of those, 3 to 6 are expected to form into hurricanes, with a possible 1 to 3 major hurricanes. So a major hurricane is a category 3, 4, or 5, and that's wind speeds at or above 111 miles an hour.
And hurricane season starts soon, right? Sooner than people might think.
Yes, June 1st and goes until November 30th.
All right. CAI science and environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyce. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks, Mindy.
Controversy has been swirling around the Chappie Ferry, the quaint cash business that's shuttled fishermen, tourists, and homeowners between Chappaquiddick and Edgartown for decades. Now the sale of the operation is imminent, and that's leaving some year-round residents worried about an essential service that might be overseen by a New York investment firm. CAI's Sam Houghton spoke with Peter Silkowski, an active Chappie resident and owner of Bait and Tackle Shop in Edgartown, to see how residents living on the remote island are coping with the news.
Peter Wells has run the operation, I think, for decades. He's understandably looking to retire. There's not been a lot of publicity on who is taking over the ferry. What do you know about who would take this over, and why are some people on Chappie nervous?
Yeah, well, we got told in early March that a gentleman named Brian Scow, who became a ferry captain 12 to 18 months ago, we were told in March that he was in support by six investors from New York were going to purchase the assets of the ferry. So they're not buying the business, they're buying the assets of the ferry for $2.9 million. And that's pretty much all we know. The challenge we have, you know, going forward is the Chappie Ferry is an essential public service run by a private operator under the license and governance of the town of Edgartown through the select board. But the transparency of things like financials or the transaction of the deal are only shared with the town. So the public has no knowledge of who these people are and any of the financial implications.
And I think the overall point, though, is the Chappie Ferry doesn't seem like it could necessarily make a lot of money unless you raise prices a lot.
And that's kind of, when you think of it, it's a monopoly. It's not going to increase volume, and it's currently the assets they purchase are three-car ferries. The youngest one was built in 1975. From a point of view, a simple investment capability is how do I increase the value of a business?
Right.
Either I increase the customers, increase the profitability by better operations, or I raise prices. Now,
right.
The current rate for a car is $17 a round trip, which on a per mile basis, $85 a mile, it's the most expensive ferry in the country. And they don't even serve drinks. Yeah, imagine that. It's like the cover charge to a bar and you don't get any drink passes.
There's been a report published by Chappie residents that have some really interesting ideas in there. One of them is that the Vineyard Transit Authority maybe take it over. Another that maybe a nonprofit should be formed to look at it. What do you and other Tappy residents see as the perfect outcome here?
This is not the first time that this has come up. Every time there's a rate increase, trust me, there's always this sort of buzz that goes around the Chappy residents. This should really be part of a public infrastructure. You know, people say it's just part of the road system. I think all of us are just trying to make sure that we have both a strong operation, and I will say Peter Wells has done an amazing job of running the ferries. He's improved it, and we just want to continue that. But we recognize there's aging infrastructure, sea level rise, and other factors that says that gets you a little nervous. And I think it's just a matter of ensuring that the rates are fair and consistent and that there's some transparency to its cost. And it needs to be subsidized. It needs to be subsidized. But I think all of us just want to have a sustainable operation is what we're all focused on.
It is interesting to me, you know, there's another ferry service to the island, the Steamship Authority, that's always controversial as well. And they're similar in that they're both kind of monopolies overseeing this one route.
Here's the big difference. The steamship is called a quasi-public entity. It was formed out of the government. What I think of the Chappy Ferry, it's a quasi-private. It was a private operation with public kind of dimension. The big difference is, and whether we like it or not, you can look at the steamship and look at their books, talk to the board of directors, everything's public, of why they may not be as effective as they should, right? You can look and say, they blew money on $4 million on a website that didn't work. You know, they overspent on certain things, but that's all public. You can look at something and say, this isn't right. I can't do that with the ferry. I can't look at anything.
What could the town do to ensure that there is more transparency going forward?
The biggest thing for us is the license agreement of defining what transparency is, setting expectations of what the ferry owner should disclose to the town. I'm not saying public disclosure. I don't want to go all the way there. And then the expectations that the town looks at it. And I think the third part is make sure it's not just the select board, that it's a broader, potentially even outside the scope of what I call the town, that the town would designate maybe a community member to see it. But my point is that you can look at it to justify either the deal or justify the rate increase or other important decisions, that there is a confidence from the community that kind of due diligence is happening.
That is Chappaquiddick resident Peter Sulkowski. Thanks so much, Peter, for joining us and helping us understand this.
All righty, thanks.
The Edgartown Select Board could approve the sale of the Chappy Ferry operation on Monday. Coming up, a pilot program in one Cape town allowing dogs on a public beach this summer. Stay with us. You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point. It is town election season, and Josh Balling from the Inquirer and Mirror is here to update us on Nantucket's town election. Hi, Josh.
Good morning.
All right, so give us the highlights.
It was a big night on Tuesday. It went quite long, given the fact that there was a write-in candidate for a select board. So we didn't even get the results until almost midnight. But when it all played out, it was a big day for most incumbents and that select board candidate running as a write-in, Bob DaCosta, along with about $200 million in capital spending that was all approved at the ballot. With no incumbents in that select board race, Finance Committee and Capital Program Committee Chair Jill Veith, who was on the ballot, and former select board member DaCosta running as the write-in, beat Clifford Williams, who was running for the 16th straight time in the race for two of those three-year seats on the board. In the only race where the incumbent didn't win, charter fishing captain Brian Borgeson, who was sort of the face and voice of the successful short-term rental regulation articles passed at the special town meeting in November, beat the incumbent planning board member Hillary Rayport by about 100 votes in the race for that five-year seat. And Tim Leprey and Chantal Blois-Murphy went back to the school committee. Neil Patterson's back on the Land Bank Commission. Peter Brace is back on the Harbor and Shellfish Advisory Board. And Curtis Barnes and Nelson Eldridge are back on the Water Commission. And all the big ticket spending items on the ballot, including even one that didn't pass town meeting, were approved pretty handily by voters on Tuesday. It was one of the most expensive town meetings in terms of proposed spending in recent memory. About $200+ million in borrowing for major town projects was approved, both at town meeting and the ballot box. The approved spending includes a new R. Island Home skilled nursing facility back for its second try this year, and it passed quite handily at town meeting and with about 62% of the vote at the ballot box. Outdoor athletic facility upgrades at the high school, which was a little controversial given the proposal to put a synthetic turf track and field and track there. That passed about 59% of the vote at the ballot box. Town employee housing and a major sewer expansion for about $44 million. All that passed. Turnout was about 29%, with just over 3,000 ballots cast. And all that spending will add about just about $500 to the annual tax bill of a property with a residential exemption and about $830 to a property without it moving forward for at least the next 20 years.
And you mentioned voter turnout close to 30%, which is actually better than a lot of some of the towns on the Cape.
It is, and it's pretty good for Nantucket, too. Generally, the local elections see somewhere between 20 and 30%. I think it was the spending articles, even more so than the actual races for boards and commissions that got a lot of people out. There was about 1,200 to 1,400 people at the first night of town meeting when the school project and their nursing home project were voted on, and I think that carried over to the ballot box as well.
And then a favorite breakfast place is getting a new home, and who doesn't love their donuts?
Downey Flake Donuts will be back. It's a little unclear moving forward exactly what iteration the Downey Flake is going to have, but it is going to be back after a couple years hiatus. The property it formerly occupied was sold a couple years ago, and the Downey Flake in that spot was demolished to make way for a commercial and residential project. But the Downey Flake is going to the new Fairgrounds restaurant on Fairgrounds Road. At least for now, there's going to be Downey Flake Donuts, coffee, maybe some breakfast sandwiches out of a hot case. And the plan is, moving forward at some point anyway, to bring the Downey Flake back with sit-down service, the blueberry pancakes that everybody loved,
right.
Breakfast place. it's great to have them back in the neighborhood. The owners, Ron Oldham and Patty Kennedy, worked with new Fairgrounds owner Ethan Devine to really sort of expand Fairgrounds' options to not just lunch and dinner anymore, but breakfast. So at first, anyway, it'll be takeout, but the plan and the hope is that there'll be sit-down Downey Flake service at Fairgrounds sometime probably after the summer. They'll start thinking about it.
All right, Josh Balling from the Inquirer and Mirror. Thanks, Josh.
Thank you.
A growing number of cash paid for homes on the Vineyard having an impact on the island real estate market. Emma Kilbride from the Vineyard Gazette joins us. Hi, Emma.
Hi, good morning.
So this is a surprising number of homes being sold for cash.
Yeah, absolutely. So over the past year, 41% of all island real estate purchases have taken place in cash. And for properties over $5 million, that number rises to 72%.
Yeah, which is 72%. That's like, wow. And so how is this impacting the real estate market?
Absolutely. So first, in a regular non-vacation market, usually between 10 and 20% of homes are sold in cash. So this is a very kind of outsized thing that's happening here on the Vineyard. And what this does is it attracts buyers who have more money. They have the cash to put forward immediately. And they have that kind of financial flexibility that drives up prices. And then when prices go up, then that attracts more cash buyers again. So it's sort of a self-reinforcing cycle.
Yeah. And of course, the sellers love cash, cash purchases, right?
Exactly. It's very attractive for a seller to accept a cash offer because there's no financing component, there's no inspection that's required, and they can accept whatever the seller thinks it's worth because there's no appraisal value that is driving the situation. Yeah. So as they say, cash is king.
Yeah. And of course, this doesn't really bode well for, first time home buyers, right? Or those like that can't afford 5 million plus.
Well, it's certainly getting harder to compete, especially because even on the lower end of the market, if there are all these cash buyers coming in and you're a first-time home buyer or you don't have the money to buy something outright and you have to finance, you have to be competitive and strong against that cash offer. But there are certainly ways to remain competitive, according to one lender at Leader Bank, who I spoke to, who said that they have something called a purchase pass, which is essentially a full commitment for a loan in hand that a buyer can have before they make an offer on a home, which allows them to essentially be able to make a cash offer that's actually financing at the same time as some of these more competitive buyers.
Yeah. And of course, this isn't just happening on the Vineyard. I'm sure we're seeing the same thing on the Cape and Nantucket as well. Emma Kilbride from the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Emma.
Thank you.
In most towns, dogs are not allowed on public beaches in the summer months, but a new pilot program is making some exceptions in Chatham. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle joins us. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
All right, before we get to that story, though, I want you to bring us up to date on town elections, both in Chatham, Brewster, and Harwich.
Sure. Let's start with Harwich. Harwich had their election Tuesday, and there was only one contested race for the Brooks Free Library trustees, and Kathleen Ann Cockcroft and Lynn Budell won those two seats. The big item, though, was $11.8 million debt exclusion for the Monomoy Regional Middle School roof, which had been a bit controversial, but it ended up passing pretty handily by 732 to 253 votes. And the town also passed two other debt exclusions. Moving over to Brewster, there was a competitive select board race. And in that contest, Laura Labden came up victorious in her fourth run for the board. Her last two times, she lost by 5 votes. So her 136-vote margin here was a pretty strong victory for her. Voters also approved 3 Proposition 2.5 overrides in Brewster for the town operating budget and school budgets. Moving over to Orleans, the big question there was the fire station debt exclusion, which was a $55 million question, and that passed by 1,058 to 713. And in Chatham, which had their election last Thursday, Randy Potash came in on top of a field of 4 candidates. So she's the town's newest select board member. And the town also approved 2 debt exclusion questions for replacement of bulkheads at the Barnhill and Ryder's Cove town landings. Right. So that's kind of a wrap-up of the elections in our area.
Highlights,
over the last
week. And then, as I mentioned, this pilot program in Chatham is going to allow dogs on a section of Harding's Beach. Tell us about that.
Yeah, as you said, Mindy, in most Cape towns, especially including Chatham, dogs are prohibited from the beaches, public beaches, from May 1st to September 15th. And the reason for that is there's two main reasons. One is to prevent conflicts between beachgoers and dogs, and the other is to protect nesting shorebirds along the coast. In many towns, these areas are you see piping plovers and terns nesting there, and dogs can cause disruption to that nesting. But there's been sort of a push in Chatham to provide other areas where dog owners could walk their pets during the summer months, and the town and the select board and the Park and Rec Commission recently approved using a what's called the Marsh Trail at Harding's Beach, which is not along the water, but sort of on the backside of the barrier beach. It goes along a marsh area for about 3/4 of a mile. And that trail will now be open to dog walking during the summer. Mm-hmm. It's, as you said, it's a pilot program to see how it works. There are piping plovers that nest in the area, and officials are going to keep a close eye on whether this allowing dogs on that trail impact the birds at all.
Yeah, and they'll be on leash. This is not unleashed dogs. These are dogs on a leash.
Definitely, you need to keep your dogs on a leash on the beach for sure.
Yeah, and if dog owners follow the rules, we might see it expanded, right?
Yeah, that's the idea. Is if this works out, then this trail and perhaps other areas could be opened up to dogs during the summer, which would give us dog owners another option to exercise our pets.
Excellent, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
A lottery for the 65-unit apartment complex in Provincetown drew a lot of applications. Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent joins us. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Mindy.
All right. So tell us more first about this complex.
Sure. The process for these apartments has been underway since 2019, And they've actually been under construction. It's about a $44 million complex, four buildings with the 65 units. They're almost all affordable. There's a couple that are reserved for the Department of Mental Health, and there's four market rate units. But we're talking about almost 60 affordable apartments. Right. And yeah, when the lottery was held, it was a lot of people.
655 applications?
Yes. And I think even the bigger number is that 243 of them were local preference, which means either they live in Provincetown already, they have a job in Provincetown, or their kids are in Provincetown schools. So 243 households of people who needed these affordable apartments. And there's only, 58 of them to go around.
Wow, this is just mind-blowing. So who's eligible for this lottery?
So anyone in the state can apply, right? But then 70% of the units are held for local preference. So they do that part of the lottery, they fill those units, and then the local people are again allowed in the regular part of the lottery for the other 30% of the units. So it tends to be a lot of people who live on Cape Cod who wind up in these apartments, even though anyone in the state is allowed to apply. And yeah, the lottery goes through all 655 names, actually application numbers. You couldn't see the names while this was happening, which was very confusing to the people involved.
Yeah.
And then they would figure out where they were on the list. And then, if they have a disability, they would actually be moved. There's a lot of shuffling that happens based on these very complex state rules. So pulling a 250, for instance, for this 83-year-old woman was very terrifying at first, but sort of she realized, well, given a disability and given some other things, she might actually wind up in one of these apartments after all.
Yeah, well, it just really goes to show how hard our affordable housing issue is, right? All right, Paul Benson from the Provincetown Independent, thank you so much.
Thank you, Mindy.
Coming up, the Museum of African American History could receive $1 million in state funding. You're listening to the News Roundup. We head up to Beacon Hill now, where CAI's Gilda Geist talks to our State House reporter, Katie Lannon.
The Museum of African American History, which has locations on Nantucket and in Boston, could soon get some money from the state. So how much money and where's it coming from?
We're talking about $1 million here, and this would be from an account within the Massachusetts Marketing Partnership, which is essentially a tourism effort that goes towards local projects. Of course, because a history museum is educational, it's also a tourism driver. This is something the Senate added to their version of the state budget during debate this week, and we will see if it makes it through the final talks with the House. They'll have to convince state representatives to go along with it.
Why do lawmakers want funding for the museum now?
They see this as a countermeasure to funding cuts that the museum has experienced under the Trump administration, as they've pulled back money both from the Park Service and from initiatives attached to diversity, equity, and inclusion. The lawmakers who back this effort say they'll support the museum's infrastructure and educational materials and help to make sure that the museum is able to tell the truth about Massachusetts and about American history.
Governor Maura Healey has appointed three new members to the Cannabis Control Commission. So who are these new members?
The new chair under Healey is Christopher Harding, who is a former commissioner of revenue for the state. He's also worked in Healey's Health and Human Services Secretariat. Joining him are attorney Anthony Wilson, who's been a city clerk in both Springfield and Cambridge, and the Amara de Lobato, who works in economic development in Western Mass. So it looks like while there's some geographic balance on this, it doesn't quite stretch into Cape Cod representation.
All right. And finally, the State House is working on a bill to regulate people's use of robotic devices like drones. So what kinds of activities involving robots would be limited under this bill if it became law?
Essentially, this would prohibit people from weaponizing drones or other robotic devices, attaching maybe a bomb or some sort of other device to do harm, or for using drones to harass people. Now, military use of dog robots and other robots, think to defuse a bomb or things like that, would still be available both by the military and by police departments, particularly if they have a warrant for any sort of surveillance activities. One of the lead architects of this bill says she was actually inspired by an incident in Hyannis a couple of years ago where a robot dog was used to locate an armed suspect inside a house and help resolve the situation, but that dog was shot three times. But there were no harms to any officers or civilians. So what she says is that really showed the promise of robotics when it comes to these sort of law enforcement uses, but got her thinking about the potential to misuse these kind of technologies as well. So that's the line that House lawmakers are really trying to tread here with this bill, is making sure that there are approved kind of public safety ways to harness this new technology, but that people aren't really trying to do harm with them as well. So that's a bill that the House passed this week, and it now is going to be considered by the state Senate. So we'll see if they like that idea as well.
All right. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Singer-songwriter Tom Rush has been part of the American music scene since the early 1960s. He's performed around the world and has a long list of records. He has an upcoming performance on Saturday, May 23rd in Oak Bluffs at the Strand Theater. CAI's John Basile sits down with Tom Rush to talk about his career.
This is my 67th annual farewell tour. I'm looking forward to the next 67.
How do you stay current and relevant with all the changes that are going on around us?
I've never been accused of being relevant before. That's a new one. I have fun playing for people. That's basically it. For me, the touring, the travel is the work. The time on stage is the fun part.
And that leads me right to my next question. You seem to be one of those people who is so at home on stage. Every time I've seen you perform, it just seems so natural to you. Has it always been that way for you?
No, I got nervous at first. First few times I had to get up on stage, I really didn't want to. In fact, I got fired from my very first paid job. It's a place called the Salamander in Boston. And a friend of mine was a flamenco guitar player who played there every, Tuesday night maybe. And he was going to go to Spain and live with the gypsies, who of course didn't want anything to do with him. But he asked me if I'd like to take over his job playing at the Salamander once a week. And I showed up and they propped me up on a stool in the corner and I played for the people and they seemed to be enjoying it. They clapped and they were listening and having a good time. And at the end of the night, the guy gives me my $10 and said my services would no longer be required. And I said, but I thought people were really enjoying the show. And he said, that's the problem. We don't want them listening to some folk singer. We want them playing chess and drinking coffee and having conversations. Get out of here. So it's been downhill ever since. After getting over being nervous, I've really enjoyed, I look at the shows as a conversation. Kind of a one-sided conversation, admittedly, but it's a conversation with the audience.
For people who don't know your background, you were raised in New Hampshire, went to Harvard. How did a young man going to Harvard become so interested in music from an earlier time, the blues and that sort of thing?
Well, when I said this is my 67th annual farewell tour, I decided recently to start the clock when I first got paid to make music, and that would have been street singing in Paris, summer of 59. And my parents had sent me to Europe for the summer before college, and I ended up street singing. It was kind of weird. I started trying to street sing in London, and people would actually cross the street to avoid me. But then in Paris, it was quite easy to draw a crowd. Anyway, I went from there to Cambridge to go to start college. And Cambridge at that time was just so full of music. It was a lot of folk music going on. All these kids playing, Delta blues and Chicago blues and bluegrass and Irish Scottish ballads and all over the place. And it did occur to me at the time, there was a certain irony in a bunch of Harvard students sitting around singing about how rough it was in the coal mines. But we figured we could get over it with sincerity. We could make up for what we lacked in authenticity. But I got sucked into the folk music scene. And there was this little coffee house called the Club 47 that was one block from my dorm. And it was just irresistible. I almost flunked out. because I spent too much time at the Club 47 and not enough time studying. I was an English lit major. And when I graduated with an English lit degree, I realized pretty quickly nobody is paying me to read books. The people were paying me not much, but paying me a little bit to get on stage. So I figured, well, I'll do this, keep doing this till I figure out what I want to do in life. And I'm still trying to figure out what I want to do in life.
Now, you've got those early albums I'm looking at, Got a Mind to Ramble and Blues, Songs and Ballads. Those were for Prestige. And then you went over to Elektra Records, which was just starting to blossom at that time into one of the really major labels. And you always seem to have that ability to find a good song, no matter where you were recording. How did that come about? For instance, I'm looking at that Jackson Brown song, Shadow Dream Song. I don't think he's ever recorded it, but you had it on a record in the mid-60s.
I meant to call her name. I meant to take her hand. I meant to be the same and understand.
And you were one of the first people to record Joni Mitchell songs.
I was the first.
And I woke up today and found the frost perched on the town. It hovered in a frozen sky and gobbled summer down. When the sun turns traitor cold and shivering trees are standing in a naked road.
But actually, you missed a vinyl. My very first album was called Live at the Unicorn. A guy came in. I was playing once a week at this club in Boston called the Unicorn. This guy came in and said, "Do you want to make an album?" And I said, "Yeah, sure." I'd heard that before. Nothing had ever come of it. But he actually dragged this recording machine the size of an oven down the steps into the Unicorn and recorded for two nights, chopped it up, and made an album out of it.
You know, Mom, I got rambling on my mind. Yeah.
He actually had it pressed himself. This was not a real label. And he distributed it out of the back seat of his Studebaker. But I remember going into the Harvard Coop record store right in Harvard Square because my album was on the racks. And this was very exciting. And I went and I saw my album. It was in the folk section. And I called the manager over and I said, "Yes, I do some traditional folk, but I also do some blues." And he said, "Okay," and moved me over into the blues section. And I said, "Well, wait, but I also do some country." I ended up in miscellaneous and learned my lesson not to argue about genres. Anyway, Jackson and Joni and James Taylor, I was accused by Rolling Stone of ushering in the singer-songwriter era because I put out this album called The Circle Game, named after, of course, Joni's song. And it was the first time that Joni, Jackson, and James had been recorded by anybody. So I somehow was guilty for ushering in the singer-songwriter era. I've denied any involvement.
You've also written a few real good ones yourself. No Regrets, I know, and things like that.
I know you're leaving, it's too long.
Took me a while. No Regrets actually was, I think, the third song I ever wrote. It's by far the one that's been recorded the most by other artists. Emmylou Harris and Waylon Jennings and all, on and on and on. And this band in England called the Walker Brothers had a huge hit with No Regrets. Put my first two kids through college. And off of that, a whole bunch of other people recorded it, including this band from Ireland, something called U something. And I actually saw an interview with Bono where the writer said, "So you covered No Regrets?" And Bono's response was, "Yeah, that's Scott Walker. He's a genius." And I said, "Excuse me, over here." And I finally went to a show they were doing in Phoenix and spent some time backstage before the show went up, and he apologized. More recently, I've started writing my latest album called Gardens Old, Flowers New, folks, is all songs I wrote. And the previous album is also all songs that I wrote. So I've written more songs in the past 10 years than in the first 50 years of my career. And I don't know why, but I'm not going to complain.
Do you find that later in life you have different things to say in your songs than maybe earlier in life?
I don't, you know, no. The simple answer is no, because I don't know where the songs come from. I do not sit down to write a song about something, except No Regrets. That was the case there, but it was a bit of a weird story. For your folks who don't know about No Regrets, it's about the end of a long love affair. And I wrote it actually about the end of a long weekend love affair. This girl came up from New York to Cambridge and spent the weekend with me. And I'd never spent that much time with anybody before. And when I took her to Boston Logan to put her on a plane back to New York on Monday, it felt strange walking away alone. And I went back to my apartment and wrote this song as though it was the end of a long love affair, which then actually came true. We had a many years relationship and it finally ended. But that song I wrote on purpose, but mostly songs just sort of happen. I don't know where they come from. My idea is that there's this cloud of songs that exists out somewhere on the edge of the solar system, like the Oort cloud of comets, and they come drifting through, and my job is to catch them before they drift away again. Sometimes it doesn't work.
You must really enjoy performing in front of an audience. I'm looking at your schedule. I see Pennsylvania, California, of course, here on Cape Cod and throughout New England. And I know you mentioned the travel earlier. There must be an energy that you get from an audience.
Absolutely. Absolutely. As I said earlier, it's kind of a one-way conversation, but I'm very much looking forward to coming and playing in Oak Bluffs. Yeah, I'll be at the Strand mm-hmm. on, what is it, 23rd, Saturday the 23rd. And then in Falmouth at a place called The Lounge on Sunday the 24th, but that one's sold out. The Strand in Oak Bluffs is not sold out as far as I know. Anyway, I have a lot of friends on the Vineyard. I used to spend my summers on the Vineyard back when I was a teenager. I'd go and visit my Aunt Sarah in Chilmark, and she was a bad influence. I loved her for that.
Now, when people come to your Vineyard show, what can they expect? Is it new songs, old songs, stories to tell? What's the mix?
Yes. The answer is yes. Yes, yes, and yes. Well, of course, I'll be doing some of the old favorites, because that's why people go to shows, is to hear the songs they know and love. So I'll be doing some of them. I've got some new ones from the new album, Gardens Old, Flowers New, which people seem to love a lot. I've got a couple of brand new ones that I haven't recorded yet. One called It Takes a Whole Lot of Liquor to Like Her. Goes over very well. And I've got this youngster with me, Brendan Cleary. I heard this kid playing in a bar, the Hilton Hotel in Boston, and I was just walking through the lobby. I didn't get a chance to stop and listen, but I thought, he's too good to be playing in a bar. And so earlier this year, I called him and asked him if he'd like to be my accompanist for a while. And he's been working with me now since January. And he'll be backing me up, but he'll be doing a few songs on his own during the course of the show. He steals the show, and I pay him to do it. What is wrong with me? But he's really, really good. Brendan Cleary, Cleary. Look him up.
Tom Rush, thanks so much. We will see you in Oak Bluffs later this month.
It's a deal. It's a date. Thank you, John.
And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
And there's a southern wind and skies are blue. Come on, let's go see.